From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 1-800-NOW-OPEN or open.com.
This October's surprise might not influence the outcome of November's elections, but it just might influence where you dine tonight. Gourmet Magazine has just published its much-anticipated America's Top 50 Restaurants list, and Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, joins us as part of her monthly series on this show, along with John Willoughby, Gourmet's executive editor, and they're here to talk about what it was like to eat their way across the country. It must have been a painful experience. Well, Ruth, you vowed you weren't going to review restaurants. You'd had enough of that, and here you are. Did you go to every one of these restaurants?
Almost every one. There were some that we deputized people to go to, but we tried to hit all of them, and many more that aren't
make
on
the list.
Yes.
So is this the first time a magazine like Gourmet has tried to rate the best restaurants in America?
No, we did this 5 years ago. We decided we would do this every 5 years. And the big surprise, I think, for both of us is that there are 30 restaurants on this list that were not on the list 5 years ago, which really speaks to what's been happening with restaurants in America these days. I mean, restaurants have gotten so exciting and so good that you actually can have that kind of change.
So the 30 that are not here, did they go out of business or did they go into decline or did 30 new restaurants come along that just were so much better?
They did not go into decline. I mean, that was the painful part about this is that there are 30 restaurants that were great and for the most part still are. But we really felt like there were, you know, these newcomers who were terrific, who you couldn't ignore.
John, how do you go about choosing the 50 best restaurants in America? Where do you start? New York, because that's where you're based?
Well, we have people all over the country who work for us as reporters, and they sort of send us their recommendations. So when we decided to do this again about a year and a half ago, we started just telling everybody, send us your recommendations, send us your ideas. And we also, you can get a lot of information from the internet. If you go to local talks, you know, local little internet sites around the country and just look at what people are saying about the restaurants in that city. So we have a huge list to work from.
But despite the fact that the Zagat guides are valuable in a certain way, the people who are serious in the restaurant world do not necessarily rely on them. Popular acclaim isn't always the best way to judge a restaurant, is it?
No, not at all. But you get an idea what restaurants people are talking about. They may not necessarily like them the most, but you do get an idea from what's new, just because we need to know what's new, what's coming up. Are the old ones still there? How are they doing? So it just gives us an idea, not of how to rate them, but of which ones to go to.
So what were your criteria? What were you looking for when you were judging these places? Was it just the food or the overall experience? If the food was excellent and the service was lousy, did the restaurant not make the cut?
Well, these are the top 50 restaurants in the country, so they've got to be good at everything.
But a great chef with a lousy waiter is still a great chef.
But it's not a great restaurant.
It's, you know, these are places we're telling people you really have to go to these restaurants. And if we went in and had, no matter how wonderful the food, if you have a rotten experience there, it's not going to make the list.
So you compiled a list of, for this 50, of how many?
Oh, we must have started with about 500 restaurants that we felt we really needed to check out.
And how many of them did you personally check out?
Oh, probably 400.
See, it really? Seems like 400. We did a lot of traveling. Well,
you don't, and you didn't put on a lot of weight. Well, did you walk from place to place?
We did. There are many tricks to doing this, which I learned from Ruth, who has more experience than I in this. The first time we did this, you know, you do three or four meals in a night in a city, was a few years ago, and we were in the middle of a dinner, and I looked over, and Ruth's plate was empty. And I knew she had not eaten that food, because I was just beginning. And she had a plastic bag in her purse into which she had put in all her food. There are many tricks which you learn to be able to have three or four dinners a night and really not kill yourself.
So you took a taste and then you saved the rest of the food, or you just decided you weren't going to send it back to the kitchen and have them say what's wrong?
Well, that's it. I mean, if you're having three dinners a night, the last thing you want is to have – you can't eat all the food. You can get a very good sense of how good it is in two bites. And
it's like a wine tasting.
And mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And except, no, you don't spit it out. You swallow it. You eat it. But you don't eat it all. And you don't want the chef to come out and look at your nearly full plate and come out and want to know what's wrong. And you just don't want to go through the explanations. I mean, the other thing that I've found really useful, I have two other really useful tricks. And one is get friends with teenagers to come with you. Because teenagers think it's really cool to eat three expensive meals in a night, and they'll eat everything. And also, you never get the best service when you walk in with, two moms and three kids. It's
right. They're not saying, "Oh, here's a restaurant reviewer."
Exactly. Right. It's like, "Oh, how do we bury these people?" And the other thing is, don't waste time on a restaurant that isn't going to be worth it. If you walk in, you have one bite of the first course, and you go, "Oh no, this is a mistake."
Suddenly, you get a cell phone call.
You get a phone call, and there's an emergency. You need to leave right away.
How many of the 400 or 500 would have turned up that way? I would assume that if people are recommending restaurants, that they'd never be that bad.
Oh, but there are some. One I can remember in particular, the appetizers came, they set them down, we looked at each other, we each took a bite, and we knew that this was not a place we were interested in. And it had been recommended by all kinds of people. So, you know, people have different tastes, and some people who are not experienced are impressed by elaborate menus and elaborate restaurants and really not paying that much attention to the food.
My guests are the two top editors at Gourmet Magazine, John Willoughby, the executive editor, and Ruth Reichel, the editor-in-chief. And this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We're talking about Gourmet Magazine's restaurant issue and its list of the 50 best restaurants in America. So did people fight over – there are some restaurants that are really famous that I would assume everybody wanted to eat at. Did people fight over the opportunity to eat at the French Laundry, for example?
Yes. People did fight over many of these. And actually, there are still people in the office who are barely speaking with us because on the return visit, we went to – the restaurant that we decided was the number one restaurant, obviously.
In Chicago.
We had a very funny experience because Doc and I tried to go like a month after they opened, went out to the airport. We were just going for dinner to spend the night and come back. And we got out to the airport at about 4 o'clock and this rainstorm hit and we just sort of watch dinner go past us. We waited for the storm to pass. But I finally got there by myself, was stunned by how good the food was, knew we had to go back. And there are people in the office who won't speak to us because they didn't get to come on that meal.
Right.
Well, first of all, we should point out that John Willoughby is called Doc by all of his friends.
Right.
So how did you decide that it was the best restaurant? What made it stand out from all the rest?
I found everything about the experience of eating there completely original. Every dish, and this is the kind of food, it's like Adria-like food,
Now, we should point out that there's a chef named Farhan Adria, who many people consider the most important chef. I don't know whether he's the greatest, but the guy who seems to be pointing the way, and he's in this small town in the middle of nowhere in Spain, and yet people make pilgrimages to this restaurant. What, he's only open half of the year?
He's open half the year, and he does experiments in his laboratorio the other half of the year.
So this guy is kind of, what's his name?
Grant Achatz.
And he's kind of like Adria?
Well, he is doing very experimental food. He's never worked with Adria, but he's taken his cues from him, as many chefs in the United States have. I mean, here in New York, we have WD-50, which does that kind of food. And it's very experimental. It's really thinking out of the box. And I'm very skeptical about people trying to do this because it's very difficult to do well, and you end up with a lot of very stupid food in the name of science and experimentation. This is a 31-year-old chef who everything he puts in front of you is unexpected, gorgeous. I mean, half this food, it's so beautiful you wish you could wear it like jewelry, and absolutely delicious.
And give me an example. What is a dish that you thought was particularly stunning that I would want to book the next flight to Chicago for?
Well, one of the first bites that I got there was something he calls hot potato, cold potato. And the other thing is he's invented all of the dishes and the implements that you eat this with. It's all, you know, nothing is ordinary there. So this
sounds like something David Cronenberg thought up.
This comes in a little paraffin cup that is about the size of a large Boulon oyster, and it has cold potato soup in it, and there's a pin sticking out of it with a little hot potato puff and a slice of truffle on top of that, and you pull out the pin, the little potato puff drops into it with its truffle, and you eat it as if you were slurping an oyster.
And but the pin is prevented it from getting soggy
Until you do this. And what you taste in your mouth is sort of every permutation of potato. It's one little slurp. It's completely delicious. It's really fun to eat. And you end up sort of laughing after you've eaten it because it's so wonderful.
But can this have the same kind of impact on American cuisine as someone like Alice Waters had, where she just went back to the basic ingredients and brought out the essence of the flavors without any trickiness? Or somebody like Wolfgang Puck when he came up with his version of California Nouveau Cuisine?
Well, I think it's interesting. Right now, I think there are three main schools of food in this country, and one is classic French-inflected food, which is like the French Laundry in Per Se or Daniel. One is the revolution that Alice wrought, which is very simple, farm-driven cuisine. And the third is what Alinea represents, which is this very original food that's cooked in a completely different way, that's cooked in a mostly cold kitchen. And I think it is going to, you know, move it all forward.
John, what did you have that you really thought? It can't be the same potato thing.
We didn't have that when I was there, actually. First of all, I have to say, when Ruth came back from Chicago raving about this restaurant, I said, this sounds like silly food to me. We should not be promoting this. This is not. So, of course, we went back, and the meal we had was spectacular. And describing it, it does often sound silly, but the thing about it, everything tasted wonderful. There wasn't a single dish we had. We had 28 dishes. There was not a single one that didn't taste wonderful. One of my favorites was he has a technique where he brings out a pillow. They put the pillow down in front of you, and then they put a plate on it. And as the plate sinks, the weight of the plate makes the pillow deflate. It's full with aromatic air. So you're breathing in this aromatic air as you eat the dish. And it's really, another one he had was a little tiny piece of lamb that settled over smoldering branches. So the smoke is permeating the lamb as you eat it. And each one, you only have a few bites. But as Ruth said, we often just burst out laughing. And even when you, and as you were laughing, you were saying, this is one of the best things I ever tasted.
The October issue of Gourmet magazine is called the Restaurant Issue, and in it is Gourmet's selection of the 50 best restaurants in America, bound to be very controversial. We'll talk about some of those controversies after we take a little break. I'm Leonard Lopate with Ruth Reichel and John Willoughby, the editor-in-chief and the executive editor of Gourmet, respectively. Stay with us. We'll be back with more. And we're back with Doc Willoughby, Gourmet magazine's executive editor, Ruth Reichel, the editor-in-chief of Gourmet. We're talking about their much-anticipated America's Top 50 Restaurants list, which is in the current issue, the October issue, called on the cover, the Restaurant Issue. Now, a lot of these restaurants, I've never eaten at. I haven't even been to many of the cities here, but I've eaten at some of them and wouldn't have put them on my top 50 list. And then there are others that I am shocked are not here because I would put them very high on my list. So how much of this is just a subjective thing?
All food is subjective. I mean, we're talking about taste. We're talking about things that take place in the eater's mouth. So, of course, it's a subjective thing. Anyone who says otherwise, I mean, so are, you know, when the New York Times rates restaurants, it's subjective.
But isn't there also a kind of a an impulse to try to include as many different places, leave out a very, very fine restaurant in New York or Los Angeles because you want to put one in from Dallas?
Oh, no question. I mean, there's no question that if you're trying to do the whole country, you are going to leave out a lot of great restaurants because you don't want them, all of your restaurants, to be in, you know, five or six places.
But there are people who will look at this list and say, DuCosta didn't make the top 50 list, or Blue Hill at Stone Barns didn't make the top 50 list. Those are really fine restaurants. And La Rev in San Antonio is number six.
It's a great restaurant.
Better than DuCosta or
I think
oh,
so.
Yes.
I think so.
Okay, DeMarco in Houston,
it's
York
really,
Street in Dallas.
These are good restaurants. I mean, you're showing your New York bias, may I say, and maybe a little bit of your Francophile bias.
But it is subjective, and one of the great...
Well, I agree that Masa is a great restaurant. That's as un-French as you can get, but and luckily I got to eat there once. But it's also a matter of, you know, some restaurants people praise to the skies, and then I go there and say, well, what's this all about? That was kind of dull.
That does happen.
And what, too fancy or too silly?
No, it's all, it really is so subjective, and I think there are, we could do a list, I think, of the best 500 restaurants in America, and no one would disagree, really. But to do it, with you know, winnow it down to 50, you're going to always disagree with people. And that is actually part of the fun of doing this, is that everybody has their own ideas. And we get a lot of reader feedback, which actually gives us good information for the next time. And it's fun. It's fun to say, well, we liked it for this and you like it for that. It's a, you know, it is a subjective call.
Well, no steakhouses made it this year. Peter Luger was 49 in 2001. Why? What happened? Is that an anti-steakhouse bias on your part?
I am on record as loving Peter Luger. I do love Peter Luger. And maybe it is a little bit of an anti-steakhouse bias in the sense that somehow every chef in America has now decided to open a steakhouse.
And a basketball player, Michael Jordan.
Many people are opening steakhouses. For me, I like steak. I love steak, but I would not put that in the same category, you know, grilling a great steak as I would with the kind of things they're doing at other restaurants where there's much more technique and in sort of thought involved in the food.
Because it's easy to if you get a really good cut of meat and you know when to take the steak off of the grill. You can't miss.
Right. I mean, if you had a steakhouse where everything else was also spectacular and very original and just really the best of everything that you'd ever had? Sure. But I didn't eat at any of those places this year.
No, I didn't either. And I mean, may I also say that one of the things that changed since the last time we did the list is Las Vegas. I mean, you could do this list and have half the restaurants be in Las Vegas. I mean, there are a lot of really good restaurants.
Now, why
in
all
Las
these
Vegas?
Great chefs going to Las Vegas? One of the most famous chefs in the world, Joel Robuchon, who just opened a place here, but has been in Las Vegas for a while with two restaurants. Why
restaurant
there first?
In Las Vegas is so good. It is so good. Because the economics of restaurants are completely different in Las Vegas than anywhere else in the world.
There's a great story about Danny Meyer. Somebody said, I'm going to ask you a question about restaurants in Las Vegas. And he said, whatever the question is, the answer is money.
So people can do things there because they know that they can have diners spend $500 for a bottle of wine without blinking.
Without thinking. Originally, the casinos where the restaurants were didn't care if they lost money. So they were
guaranteed a profit. Oh, they used to offer these real cheap meals.
Well, they used to. And then when they had the very high-end restaurants coming in, they also didn't care if they lost money. They were willing to subsidize the restaurants. Now, I think they have the clientele where they can charge outrageous prices and people are fine with paying them and they're making money.
You know, if you've just won $1 million at the tables, what do you care if a meal costs you $10,000?
Or if you've lost $1 million. You know, $10,000 is so little in comparison.
So is Las Vegas really expensive to eat at?
It is expensive, yes. I mean, the Robuchon, which we put on this list, and which is, I think, an extraordinary restaurant, is enormously expensive. And they do everything beautifully. You know, they bake their bread at 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
So they tell you. I know because one of my former producers just ate there and sent me. She sent me this thing and she said, Leonard, I'm sending this to you because you'll understand, which I really appreciated. And then she told me that they bring out the bread. They say, it's fresh. We just baked it at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
A little pretentious, isn't that?
It's a little pretentious, but, you know, that is part of the theater of restaurants. It does include a certain degree of pretension. And, you know, and then there's Bartolotta in Las Vegas where they fly every piece of fish, and it's a fish restaurant. It all comes in from Italy.
Well, they have to fly it in because Las Vegas doesn't have any
There's no fish there. But then they're also on the
some
list.
Some suckers at the, you know, the tables.
Right. That's true. Places like, you know, Parker's in Cleveland where, you know, that's an amazing restaurant in the middle of a place where you would not ordinarily expect there to be a restaurant of that caliber. So you have to include those restaurants on the list.
Now, how do they occur? Can a city like Cleveland keep? I've never been to Parker, so I don't know. I don't even know what kind of food they serve. But can they keep them going, or are these chefs who are all thinking, well, this is where I got my start. It's like starting on Smith Street in Brooklyn, but someday I aspire.
No, Parker Bosley actually was from Cleveland and left and went back. And he's been there for quite a long time. And he's had his restaurant in three different locations. And it's a very unprepossessing place. And when I drove up to it, I thought, I've come to the wrong place. This cannot be it. And then I went inside and ate, and the food was spectacular. So, you know, it's great to find those places, and I'm sure we missed some. But when you find one, you want to definitely promote it.
But what I was asking is, I know that people do better in a culture that demands it. And Chinese chefs have told me that Chinese food was lousy in New York until there were enough Chinese people to insist on good Chinese food. Mexican food, the same sort of thing. You have to have people to make it, and you have to have people who keep the standards up. What happens in a place where there is no food culture?
Well, increasingly, there are more and more places in America where there is a food culture, and that's partly due. I mean, we are in the throes of a real food revolution in the United States, where, you know, partly because of all this food television, where there are now, in most cities in America, big cities, there are enough people to support at least one or two really good restaurants.
You said that you were surprised in some cases. Surprised in some cases that these places turned out to be a lot better than you expected, and other cases that they turned out to be a lot worse than you expected. What was the biggest surprise? Either way.
Ooh.
There must have been a restaurant that you really expected a great, great meal and just were surprised that maybe it didn't make, maybe you didn't walk out after the appetizers, but just didn't live up to the hype.
Yeah, that was...
There was... Howland's Bar and Grill, which we had included before.
Where's that?
It's down south. And it's not the one in Birmingham.
No, it's...
I can never remember these. It's in Charleston, isn't it?
No, it's not.
We went too many places.
I think it's Birmingham, Alabama.
It is Birmingham. Yes.
It is in Birmingham.
Birmingham. Right. Yes, it is.
So my crack staff has just informed me that it's in Birmingham, Alabama.
Which had been really great, and we had a couple of people go there.
And it's a chef we love.
We've
done
chef.
Articles about Frank
We've done
Stitt.
Menus with his food.
I've always loved everything I've ever eaten there.
So what do you think happens?
Don't know.
Maybe you show up on a day when the chef is in a bad mood or, you know, his kid is sick. Then you go back. You say, okay, that may be the case. And it may just be timing. I mean, you know, restaurants go through slumps. But this was really a disappointment because we thought it was a foregone conclusion that it was going to be on our list. And, you know, there's no point in going and eating in these places if you're just going to put them on anyway.
Right. Right. That was the biggest surprise for me was in the other direction, and it was one we've already talked about, was Alinea, which I just thought was going to be silly food. So you never, there's no way to tell from someone else's
Is this the toast of Chicago right now? I mean, is it hard to get into that restaurant?
Yes. It's a small restaurant, and it is hard to get. I'll tell you another real surprise for me was I had heard there's this place in Healdsburg that people were talking about.
And this is California,
this
the wine
is
country.
In the wine country. It's just north of Sonoma. And I thought, okay, well, it'll be good. But I was not anticipating how really, really good it is. I mean, this is a chef who has enormous talent and is, you know, he's so careful that he's hired a bartender who is getting the water from the place that the scotch is made to serve scotch and water. I mean, you know, they are taking such pains with this food. And it's thrilling to do that. Or another place south of San Francisco in Los Gatos, Manresa. Wonderful restaurant. Just we reviewed it a few years ago, and I hadn't expected it to stay up there, but there it was. Just really exciting food.
Although in some cases you can go to a restaurant and discover the chef left last week, and that can work both ways too. But in some cases these places seem to be there are other trends. For example, we mentioned Chez Panisse and the freshest ingredients. There's a place called Arrows in a town I never heard of, Ogunquit, Maine.
Ogunquit,
number 14. They have their own organic garden and greenhouse that's tended by 3 full-time gardeners. The only place I know like that's close to us here didn't make your list, Stone Barns at the Blue Hill of Stone Barns, which I personally would put on my list, but that's another matter. Again, the fact that stuff is so fresh, you know that they picked it 10 seconds before they started.
That's definitely another trend is chefs who have their own gardens and farms, which is they do it at Blue Hill and also at Arrows. And that really is another trend. You're seeing more and more of that, chefs who are raising their own produce so that they know it's as fresh as it can be.
Well, that's something that you see in Europe a lot. Chefs will go out in the back and pull out their herbs and some vegetables. Why do you think that's not been more common in this country?
It's really difficult. I mean, as you know from knowing Dan Barber at Stone Barns, I mean, it is not easy to... I mean,
not the farmer. He's just the guy who uses the ingredients.
Right, but it's very expensive to... you need the land. You need knowledgeable people to be raising your food. You need to be able to, you know, cook with the cycles. I mean, it really means limiting your menu. If you've decided that what you're going to do is cook out of your garden and, you know, as Dan's raising his own pigs and chickens there, well, you know, if you've gone through the spare ribs, you've gone through the spare ribs, and you have to wait until it's time to process the next pig.
The sense I have is that the move toward an American cuisine isn't necessarily inexorable. After all, the restaurant that you picked that you liked the best kind of hearkens to a famous restaurant in Spain.
Oh, on the other hand, he is an American. He's a young American chef who was trained at the Culinary Institute of America and, to my knowledge, has never cooked outside of this country. All food now everywhere in the world is very global. I mean, restaurants have been globalized just like everything else. And
that's why we see all sorts of spices, Asian spices, in French restaurants and Italian restaurants these days.
Yeah.
Everything is a bit fusion.
Right. And America has always been, more open to other people's influences than any other country. It's why we have such a rich and wonderful restaurant culture here.
Can you imagine publishing a guide the way Zagat or Michelin does? A gourmet guide?
No. No. Once every 5 years is just fine with me.
That gives us 5 years for new restaurants to come up and for the people who are mad at us to calm down.
And have you been receiving some negative feedback?
Oh, we get an amazing amount of feedback from readers, and we left out their favorite restaurant, and how could we possibly pick this other one, and also from chefs who are not happy not to be on the list. So we get a lot.
Well, I don't think you're going to make or break a restaurant. I mean, you could do that when you were at the Times, Ruth, but this place is more like a guide, I would think. If I were going to someplace in North Carolina, I might look at the list and see if there was a really great restaurant that you recommended. That's not the same thing as saying this restaurant should close because it didn't make the list.
No, of course not. And we wouldn't aspire to make or break any restaurant.
So what is it? What do you do now? Go back to just thinking about recipes, or are you going to?
We'll think of something new for next year's restaurant, but it's a restaurant issue, but it won't be the top 50, not for 5 years.
You don't look tired from all of the traveling. How many cities did you actually go to?
Oh, please. Hundreds.
It certainly seems like it. But we finished a while ago because we put this to bed a few months ago. So we've had time to rest up.
And you look refreshed, Ruth, and even more refreshed, Ruth Reichel, will be with us again next month on November 7th. And I always look forward to these food segments. I also want to remind everyone that we've been talking about the 50 restaurants that are listed in the current issue of Gourmet Magazine, the October 2006 issue, the restaurant issue, with somebody holding up, somebody eating a menu.
Eating a menu.
Is that
a real restaurant and a real edible menu, yes. And there's a chef eating his own menu.
Well, whatever turns him on. And whatever. Thank you both so much, John Willoughby and Ruth Reichel. On tomorrow's show, Ed Harris and Neil Labute tell us about their new play, Rex, at the Public Theater. And then a new documentary delves into the world of bull riding. Francine Prose wonders whether writers read the way the rest of us do. Plus, Andy Barwitz shares his Republican playbook. And also, Michael Apted checks in with 49 Up, the latest in his series about a group of people he began filming when they were just 7 years old. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Melissa Egan with Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blakeney Schick. We had help today from Paula Crossfield, Scott Goldberg, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.